All right, so we've all channeled creativity in our experiences as artists of different disciplines, and it may or may not be a mystical transaction of some kind. It may be a transaction within one's own consciousness, or it may also be a portal that admits visitors from other dimensions, other locations. And even so, it may be a personal connection, because all is one. All is one, they keep telling us. So I was in a podcast today. I had the extreme good fortune of meeting an accomplished medium and channel last year, just about this time last year. So I've known her for about a year, maybe a little more than a year. And she is an intelligent, canny, sensitive human being in her normal persona, and then she is able to contact an interdimensional being who is, you know, distinctly different from her otherwise personage, her personation, her selfhood. And it struck me, one of the things that happened in the podcast was she was doing a giveaway and she was asking questions, and she asked the question, what was the first intuitive art drawing I ever did? And I couldn't remember what it was, but I was fascinated by this person having developed a system where you could use your own mind as an oracle, where you could communicate with your higher self using personalized color meaning. And that just blew me away, because I'd been trying to do this with writing for like decades and not really being able to use it, but just kind of like becoming lost in it and enjoying the way it sometimes predicted things, or it took on a tone of knowing beyond my conscious knowledge. So I became fascinated with this intuitive art thing, and I thought, oh my God, she's made it a utility. She's made it usable. It's a system that anyone can contact. It's amazing. I got so swept up in my appreciation of the essence of that tutelage that I didn't remember what her first intuitive art drawing was. So that was kind of a disappointment for me, because I really wanted to win that candle. But what I'm really saying here is that I always, for years as a writer, sort of played around with this stuff without using it with knowledgeably, without using it to help myself, but just kind of to lose myself in and to wonder at. And that's really the amazement connection that I had with Rachel Archelaus when I met her about a year ago. And since this time, paying attention to that idea, I've understood that almost everything in my life is channeled. Almost everything in my life just automatically arrives through some portal in my consciousness. And that's why portals have been so important lately. And it's been coming up in conversations with all kinds of people, all kinds of situations. Basically, I'm just going to talk to you people. It's informal. We're just going to talk about channeling. But let me open here with one paragraph. You guys know who Jane Roberts is?
Oh, yeah. I've read that stuff. It's great.
Yeah. So she just started out as a teacher of ESP, like how to develop your extrasensory perception. They did experiments in the class taught from her living room. She ends up channeling this being calling itself Seth. Here's a sentence from this book, which is Seth's first appearance, that'll open the conversation. Modern knowledge is opening up new fields of endeavor. We can no longer afford to hide portions of human experience in the dark corners of superstition and ignorance and pretend they do not exist. We must probe realistically into all aspects of existence and explore new and old theories with open-minded speculation, imagination, and reason. Sorry, bad eyes there. But this is an objective statement that, like, we shouldn't take anything for granted, and we should be proceeding with inquiry. The word is zetetic. You don't ever start knowing an answer. You always start in the position of curiosity. You proceed by inquiry. And on that note, let's talk about channeling. What's channeling been for any of you, who would like to speak first? How is channeling your own consciousness or other consciousnesses manifested in your experience?
Zach, can I ask you a question first about everything you just said?
Sure, you can.
Well, I just was wondering, you mentioned that system that you learned from Rachel,
intuitive
but
arts.
You like flew through it so fast. I was just curious.
It's called intuitive art. Everyone has personalized meanings for colors. Like, what does a color green mean to you? Might not mean the same to everyone, but it tends to mean growth, newness, vitality, springtime, or you might have a personal association with it. I think everyone has different meanings. So what you do is you draw a picture without looking when you choose the colors, without looking, and then you interpret what you've drawn in terms of color meaning. Like if you have vitality, but it's opposed by something somber, you can, you know, translate that into whatever it means in your personal life script and use it sort of as a guide, as a counsel for your experience.
Yeah, that's really just cool. It makes me think of the like chakra color system, and modern psychology has like similar uses with color associated with different personality.
Out of the brand new human experience, it doesn't have any background in psychology or any of that stuff you're referencing, but tell me more about it.
Oh, well, I was just making the connections because it's just to other like similar systems that use color to either interpret facets of the personality, or like the ancient chakras and chakric system assigns the different energy fields of the body a different color, and that color has really deep
meaning. And the difference is that this is not a system in terms of this means that, because it means something different to every person, and it's a way for you to photograph basically what's inside your mind and interpret it.
Yeah, it requires more work.
nothing against the chakra scientists.
It's kind of like a Rorschach test with colors or something.
Very much.
There's a great journal entry from Frida Kahlo where she goes through all the colors and writes them in colored pencils and like the feelings she associates. And some of them are pretty counter to the traditional, you know, green is growth feeling that people have around colors. And sure. I think, you know, if you're looking for inspiration, it's like a fun thing to just like take a crayon and color it and like write what you're feeling in your body in response to that color. I haven't worked with Rachel, but I have my own feelings about what different symbols and colors represent. And I think it's really rich to build your own.
Yeah.
Codex.
It's a lot like internal family systems. It's a psychological technique where you journal with different colors of ink. And when you're like your exile, so it looks at you as a bunch of parts, like exiled inner children, the manager, the firefighter, the executive, and each one has a different color of ink. So you actually engage dialogues with the different parts of yourself using the different colors and stuff. It's interesting.
That's interesting. It doesn't sound like it's has the same motivation behind it. It seems like it's more of a classification system, this fireman and the manager and all that. And this,
it's supposed to be therapeutic. It's for healing and integration and stuff.
All right. Yeah, I mean, she can talk about it better than I can, but it's not about psychological confrontation of your, you know, demons or anything like that. It's just taking a pic. It's just like reading a horoscope, you know?
Yeah, it reminds it. Another thing it makes me think of is soul collage, which I have never taken an official soul collage workshop myself. But I've been around it a lot, and I do a lot of my own vision boarding and collaging. But the idea is you like build an image, and then you don't assign any traditional meaning to it. But once you've completed the image, you like see what your soul is trying to speak to you through the collage.
That sounds very much like it.
I think the core question of that is, I am one who, and you look at the image and see what you're trying to tell yourself.
I like that.
Yeah, that's a good, fun way to see what's going on inside, you know?
So your process seems to be very deliberate in that you've done scenes on birds and gemstones and flowers. And
yep, this year's flowers.
It's a very deliberate process, but is it also kind of an intuitive reception of direction? Like, now I'll do gems, now I'll do flowers, that kind of thing? Or why don't you tell us what it's like?
Sure. Should I introduce myself as well? Or?
Yes, actually. Kiri Samantha Lee.
Hi, I'm Kiri, and I'm an artist and a witch. And the way my art has been manifesting most recently in the past 2 or 3 years is through zine writing and having that as like a way to be creative every week. So as Zach was mentioning, I've done 3 series, a zine on birds, a zine on crystals, and this year a zine on flowers. And for those who don't know, a zine is a self-published little booklet or pamphlet. And the way I do mine is it's an 8-page book fold. So every single one prints on one page and I write one every week. So I've done that for the past, I guess, 3 years. So I've written like over 100 zines, which is insane. And they're all about myth and magic. And to answer your question, Zach, the birds did come through a fairly sort of mystical process. I was going through a lot of transition and I was working with a different oracle deck, the Triple Goddess Oracle. And the Chariot card talks about these 7 spheres of enlightenment. And I had this other oracle deck of bird cards. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to travel through these 7 spheres of enlightenment. I'm going to draw a bird card every day for 7 days, and I'm going to paint intuitively the energy of this bird messenger while I listen to its bird song until it's complete. And so I did that for 7 days with 7 different birds, and I drew some really wacky birds. Like, I drew rooster, and I was really worried about listening to a rooster call for this whole painting, and it ended up being this really powerful experience.
I bet.
And then after finishing that, I was like, wow, I want to keep working with this bird energy, partly because some of the birds that I drew, the correspondence in the oracle deck didn't fit for me. Like, I was like, that's not what this bird represents for me symbolically. And I felt like I had some wisdom to share and a lot to learn. So I started writing 52 feathers, and I started with crow after this experience with these birds that I thought were crows, but now I know a lot more and I actually think they were ravens. and so those zines have a certain level of like my own symbolism and mythic connection with these things. So first birds and now flowers, but I also do research and I look at, you know, what has been true for millennia. So like some things have just kind of had the same meaning for a long time, like cardinals arrive in the spring. And so they have like a really strong, you know, like, and they're the word cardinal just has a lot of meaning for a lot of people. And so like in the red, right? Like there's just things that, no matter how much I have my own personal associations, those are pretty like baked into the imagery.
Yeah, those are pretty established symbols.
Right. Sure. And then like sunflower, for example, right? Like they are extremely embodied flowers. Like they look at the sun and they follow it, and then they like cry their bounty onto the earth. And the physicality of sunflower makes their meaning really obvious. Whereas like primrose, like not that many people have like watched a bunch of primrose and had a really intimate connection with that flower. Maybe the meaning of that is more up for interpretation. And so every issue I write like a little how my relationship to the object, so this year flowers, and then I write an invocation, and then I include other articles. Essentially it's like a magazine. So that's been quite the journey, and I know a lot more than I did 3 years ago, but I'm also aware that there's like a lot to know.
Always, but your zines are so instructive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I wanna get folks excited, and sometimes like there's so much survey in the metaphysical world. Like you can buy a book on crystals and there's a different crystal on every page, but it's real surface level stuff that you could like Google anywhere. Like, know, this is a crystal that's associated with Venus because it has copper in it. And it's like, well, what does that mean on a deeper level? And like, how can you work with malachite in your everyday? And so if you wanted to like deep dive into your birthstone or into your grandmother's favorite flower, there's a good chance I've written a zine about that. And so you could like get really intimate with this one thing instead of just like crystals in a more generic sense.
Yeah.
I see that zine because I've been researching crystals myself lately to try to figure out different effects and benefits. And I know what you mean. You hear a lot of the kind of surface level stuff. So that just sounds really interesting. Thanks for sharing.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Mark.
Yes. I'm taking everything in.
I understand. Do you have, has anything occurred to you that you feel like sharing yet?
Well, no, I just a random thoughts, really. One was when, I'm sorry, your name, she, her, its name.
Kiri.
Okay. Yeah. Now, when she was talking about color, I was just flashing back to, I got a chance to look at the original Carl Jung's Red Book.
Awesome.
In the Rubin Museum in New York.
Wow.
And, you know, I paint, and my process is very accidental and intuitive, and most of the time I'm not happy with the results, but as a painter, I occasionally, I'm not sure the percentage of time, but the happy accident makes for a good painting, you know, for me anyway. It's very instinctive. But I was thinking about the Jung paintings, and they are just, well, has anyone seen the inside of the Red Book? That was his great.
Doesn't it have the mandalas?
Yes, it was when he was going through like this breakdown, psychological breakdown, he painted in sort of obsessively. And when you look at the paintings in the Red Book, it's really difficult to make any sense of them. Obviously, they're very highly they have very highly individual symbolic meanings to him. I mean, they're like creatures and the color, and I was thinking of the colors when you're talking about colors. Mm-hmm. And they're obviously all over the spectrum. It's not much of a thought, but that was my reaction to that. I was just thinking about, you know, instinctive use of color, basically. And
yeah,
what you guys were talking about. Yeah.
You're talking about Jung.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, obviously these were like, in fact, I remember when he talked about these paintings, he talked about how he suspended any conscious thought and just basically played as a child with the paintings. And it's a fascinating book. Obviously, it's been pored over. You can actually buy it now. You know, they've reproduced it.
There's a small version and then like the more expensive version.
Exactly. Yeah,
I want that really bad. Actually, I have just like regular version.
I know. I wanted to do that too, and I haven't bought it, but I got a chance, as I said, to leaf through the original because the museum had it. So, and it was a big book, you know. And there was another thought that I had. Oh, I know. A random thought was, when I look at people, being someone who has studied astrology for a very, very, very long time, I really like the system. When I look at people and characters, because I'm a writer, I always think about the mystery of human character. I always think of there is a system in astrology which is, I have found to be very effective, and it's the archetypes associated with every Western. I mean, there's, astrology is very interesting because the Hindus look at it very differently from the Westerners, and so the Westerners are more psychologically, it's a psychologically themed system where the Hindus view it very differently. It's it's more of a prognostication and completely different way of viewing it. But in Western astrology, I always found it very effective if you wanted to get the key, it's sort of like what a person was like. There are archetypes for all the 12 signs, and a very simple system of looking at the sun, moon, and ascendant to sort of get a psychological picture of what a person is like on several different levels. And in fact, that harkens back to Jung, who was a great believer in astrology and used in psychoanalysis. So anyway, they were my random thoughts. I'm not being very organized tonight, but
no, it's good though. It makes me wonder if you think of your characters as having certain zodiac signs, whether or not you write them out.
I do not.
An interesting thing you might want to try. I might want to try that.
Yeah, sometime. You might want to try it. Yeah, but for instance, like in my own case, I'll just throw this out that I have a Capricorn sun and a Leo ascendant and a Gemini moon. And they, and so this system talks about how the individual identity of the person is these Capricorn archetypes, and the moon is the emotional life. And the mask presented to the world, which hides those things, is the ascendant. And I think I have found a great deal of truth. I don't know how conversant you guys are with that, since you mentioned
astrology.
And I found it to be really, you know, because astrology
there's a lot.
Yes, it's a lot, and on many different levels. I mean, from the Sabian symbols, which gives you a whole different picture. But if you want a pretty solid, I think, analysis of a character in sort of a quick method, that it's a good way to do that. So that's what passed the timeline. Yeah.
What's that method called? The archetypal?
Well, yeah.
Is there a name? Or is it just like a...
It's
just kind of diagnosing via astrology, I suppose, like diagnosing personality.
Right,
type.
Right. It's
anticipating tendencies.
That's also what developed into the modern four-letter classification system. Like Carly Jung actually developed that those astrological and mythological influences.
Right.
Really? That's interesting.
Yeah.
Like the whole introverted versus extroverted. Right. I can't remember the name of the whole system, but that all comes from what you're talking about.
Right.
Myers-Briggs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Myers-Briggs, that's it.
Yeah, lately my astrological...
I never associated that with astrology ever before in my life. Learned something new every day.
When you look at transits and progressions in a chart, it's really sort of fascinating to see what happens over the course of many years and different periods of your life.
And also to loop it back to what Zach was saying, I think those mandalas, those were portals. Those were portals for Carl Jung. Those were his portals.
Yeah. I guess they are.
Yeah, that reminded me. I have this workbook called The Mandala Workbook by Susan F. Fincher, and it's all inspired by the Red Book. And I'd forgotten.
Oh, is it really? That's interesting. Okay.
And Jungian psychology stuff. Yeah, but there's like,
what is that called?
The Mandala Workbook. I worked through this once. I don't remember how many stages there are. But each one gets more, there's 12. So it fits with like zodiac archetypes.
Yeah.
And it was very intuitive, but it was like circles and portals and entering into these different phases of your life. And
yeah.
It even reminds me of what you were saying, Charlie, with the writing from different integrations of your psyche, but through more abstract forms than words.
I didn't mean to be so oppositional to that either, Charlie. I found myself trying to talk about intuitive art and not really having the tools. I was like, don't compare it to this psychological thing, Charlie.
No.
She couldn't make a nighttime podcast. She likes to do them in the day, so she couldn't be here. I was going to have my friend Andrew he might still pop in, probably not. My friend Audrey also might still pop in, probably not. But let me tell you a story about Andrew Weibel. I met this guy at Vermont College. I went to college. I was always a bad student. I dropped out of high school. I went to community college, dropped in and out of there several times. Finally found out about this, or someone told me about a college in Vermont that gave you credit for writing whatever you were already writing, as long as you could demonstrate that you were paying attention and reading books about it and researching it and writing it. And I made hash of that thing and got out of there in a couple of years and went to grad school at the same place. Anyway, don't need to talk about that. But I met this guy, Andrew Weibel, at Vermont College. And the coolest thing about this school, you could get a diploma in whatever you wanted. You could call it whatever you wanted, fine arts or whatever you wanted. This guy had invented his own psychology called pre-ism that predated every ism. And it was basically just his word for psychic and interpsychic channeling. And do you guys know who Gogol Bordello is? I got to put in a plug here. Gogol Bordello played in the same gym a few months later, but in the graduation ceremony, Andrew Weibel had his graduation ceremony on pre-ism, and he wore a branch tied around his belly, sticking out over the top of his head with little notes tied to all the branches, all the projections of it. He would pick them off and read from them during his speech. I was standing behind the stage saying, prosopopia, prosopopia, prosopopia. And my friend Uriah Maynard was standing also behind the stage reading other things. Anyway, I'm just trying to recreate this magic thing because I realized years later that, my God, I've been on the road to understanding about intuitive art all my life. And Andrew's graduation ceremony was part of it, and my spontaneous writing was part of it, and intuitive art was part of it. And, you know, astrology spent time in that part, also another part of it. Maybe not so closely related. Astrology is more predictive, but just I wish Andrew could have come because he would have more to contribute. I always feel shorthanded when I'm trying to moderate these things, but I filled up a couple minutes there with my blabber.
Yeah. Well, I have to leave in a minute. I can't stay the full time. I'm sorry, but to bring it full circle to where you started the conversation with the first intuitive painting and something you just shared reminded me was like, I actually came to intuitive art and channeling through movement and not through words and not through art. So I worked with a group called Turning the Wheel, and they do a lot of like higher self work and in spontaneous theater and dance and getting people in touch with their most authentic version of themselves so that they can bring their genius to the world. And nice. that was the first place like I ever encountered a conversation with my higher self, but it was through dance and movement. And then that informed my journey to art and painting and writing and just ritual in general.
Right.
And so it's all based in the body. So picturing someone with like a tree grabbing, grabbing notes, it just reminded, you know, it's like that's changing your embodiment by like becoming this tree. And how does that affect?
Image. I should have played it out a little further, but I guess it's a metaphor for, you know, everyone being connected and messages being available to us all.
Right.
Yeah.
So does movement kind of help get that creative flow going for you? Like,
yeah, it's like very ping pong. Like I have studio time every week, and I'm a belly dancer as well for a different side of my brain, but I, you know, I'll move, and that will, I'll have, you know, I'll see things and have ideas, and then I'll paint them. And then the paintings will inspire me to, you know, I'll be like, oh, this makes me feel like moving like this, or is bringing up this emotion. Mm-hmm. Then I'll move it, and then that will inspire something else. And so it's very much a dialogue between, you know, what I can visualize and create to see, and then like how that manifests physically, and like getting that to shift around.
That's awesome. I mean, the obvious thing to say is it's organic, but that's how important it is. I mean, that you marvel at the obviousness of it, because I've been like cloistered in my writing zone for all these years, and I'm coming out of it now, but I like didn't realize quite how removed I had made myself until, you know, rather recently. And I'm impressed by the organic nature of your connection.
Thank you. I mean, I forget to do that too. Like I get stuck sometimes, like no inspiration in writing. Like I have a deadline, I can't get anything done. And I will forget like all of these tools that I have to like change how I'm standing, or go for a walk, or like, you know, do some creative joint play. And like, if I do remember to do those things, it's amazing how quickly the information starts flowing again, and vice versa, right? Like if all I'm doing is like movement and dance, and I'm getting really, it's like, it gets boring and there's nothing fresh and I'm losing track of things. And like, so it's helpful to like bring it back into the concrete with making images or writing a zine or painting something or doing an oracle card. Like those things, they're strongest when they're happening at the same time. But I'm no saint. I mean, I forget all the time to do one or the other.
I'm so impressed with your immersion into the creative side and doing a zine a week. Can you remember how amazed I was that you did one zine, a different zine every week when I met you? Like, are you doing a zine a week? I said, you know. But in the last couple of months, there's a couple of services that provide calls for submissions every few days, three of them. And I've been subscriber for years and never made use of them. I tell you this already. I think I did. But I've been submitting to at least two places a day for the last couple of months. And it feels so great because you don't care if they accept them, and you're a creator and you're like immersed in your creation, and that's your job. And it like sometimes you get paid, sometimes you don't. You just never stop, just keep going. And so I think I can relate.
I just wanted to say, because what both of you are talking about actually touches directly upon one of the things I wanted to mention about channeling creativity, where it's just like the energy that you infuse into whatever you're doing really dictates the quality of the flow or the river. And so, for example, if you're just creating things to make money or because out of a place of scarcity or fear, then you run in the danger of actually blocking that creative flow because you're subconsciously associating creation with like scarcity and like fear or lack of money, or just something hollow that doesn't really resonate with you in the way Kiri was talking about. And I think that's what leads to I've talked to a lot of people that talk about how they've struggled with a lack of motivation. And I think that's at like the root of that. And I know I've struggled with that in my life, or thinking of like times when I had really bad writer's block. And it's usually, I think, because I was like in this really negative state of just like, I'm just not approaching the work in the right way. Mm-hmm. And if you can approach it from a higher vibration, like a place of love, a place of magic or wonder, or whatever floats your boat, that will, you know, that's what really gets that river flowing or whatever. And I just wanted to mention that because it's easy to lose sight of that kind of fundamental fact that how much it's affected by that energy that you're putting into it.
It's all about loving what you do. It's all about fun. I mean, as simple-minded as that might sound or seem, that's really the magic answer to plenty, to plenitude of creative effulgence.
Yeah. My greatest creativity killer these days is the like social media algorithm and getting caught in that. And like, I really want to share what I like what I make when I'm doing it from a really like wholesome place. I'm like, I want people to see it. Look, and this is like, has this temptation of being a really good way to get it out there. And then I get sucked into like the numbers and who's seeing it and like, why isn't anyone seeing my art? And then it's so bad.
That's a tricky, I know what you mean. It can be a real killer of, well, and it kills your time too. You know, you keep looking.
Yeah, it's no good.
Anything on social media, it becomes public, it becomes part of the public domain. Yeah. So you don't necessarily want to post your good stuff, but you'd still want to, but you're like, I don't know if I ought to. I mean, I have never worried about it much, but I'm starting to worry about it because I'm harvesting a lot of the stuff that I posted in the past and altering it slightly and now submitting it, you know? Mm. So it's no longer in the public domain, but who knows what the hell laws there are anymore now, thanks to social media.
Really, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Sorry to bring it to that negative place, but I have to go now.
Thanks for being here, Piri. I'm sorry there wasn't more feminine energy. I invited them.
Oh, I'm happy to hold down the fort with my vibe.
Thanks for joining us and good luck to you and everything.
Thank you.
Where can we find your zines, by the way?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I'm actually
in the chat. You want to type it into the chat?
I can do that. I can speak it too. I'm online everywhere as magic with a CK underscore socks. And I'm currently running a like holiday sale. It was also my birthday. So it was like a birthday holiday sale on my Etsy. And you can find me there at artist Kiri Lee, which is just my name. And I'm doing 30% off any orders of $31 or more through December 1st for all my zines because I turned 31 this year. So that's exciting. And then I also have a Patreon, which is also at Magic Socks. And that's the best way to get a subscription. So if you want to get a zine or all of my zines every month, that's how I send them out to people. And that's been my bread and butter through the past many years. And I wouldn't be the artist that I am today with the creation that I'm doing without my patrons. So shout out to my Patreon.
Right on. Good for you, Kiri. I want to get into that too.
Yeah, but thank you. Thank you for asking. And I hope you have a wonderful rest of your conversation. I'm sad to miss it, and I'll definitely be tuning in.
Thanks, Kiri. Have a great rest of the night.
Nice meeting you.
All right, here we are.
Here we are. No, I was listening to Charlie talk about writer's block, and it's a mysterious phenomenon. Let's put it that way. I've dealt with different aspects of it for decades, off and on, and there's a lot to say about it. I ultimately, what I do when I get stuck, I mean, this is just from a very practical standpoint, is I abide by the old dictum, do something even if it's wrong. That way you get sort of untracked, you know. That doesn't have much to do with channeling, but
I think it kind of does.
The bill's turning.
And a lot of the magic in literature happens in the editing when you take those out. You need it to get to the good part, you know?
Yeah.
Or like the cut and paste method. I know we've talked about, Zach, where you just kind of write sections and it magically like comes together sometimes.
And lately it's been crazy. I've got so many stories in my computer because I belong to this writing group for like 20 years and we write something every day. And I'm finding that I can stick them together in different ways and make different stories out of them. And it's really been like a wonderland. I'm like the mad demiurge with my creations, all just different parts together.
Writing alchemist.
That's been magic. That's been a wonderful thing that happened to me this year. And well, interrupted you, but you have a lot more to say about it, I think.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh no, I've really enjoyed like experiences in the past, even writing like kind of dry academic papers. I'll just start kind of vomiting out paragraphs And then like halfway through it, I'll just be like, oh yeah, this paragraph
there it is.
Fits yeah. three pages down here. And like, totally. I just love how that comes together.
Totally.
I don't know if it's the, maybe it's our unconscious mind operating on a higher level. And it's like, don't worry, we'll like get this together eventually. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's cool how that works.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, yep.
Well, what are your current projects, Charlie? What's going on with your...
Me, my big project's moving right now, to be honest. So I haven't done a lot of like creative stuff. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I always have an itch to write like something.
And channeling doesn't always have to be creative, of course.
Well, and I guess it also reminds me like... You can be creative in like everything that you do in life. So it doesn't have to be limited to like writing or painting.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be production of art.
Yeah, and I think you can practice the same principles of like channeling creativity through everything you do, through that like mindfulness. And someone was talking about that recently today. So I just thought of that. Yeah, I don't know. I've honestly been pretty like distracted lately. So nothing too big like recently that's super exciting to talk about.
All right. Well, how about you, Mark? What do you got in the hopper?
I'm always working on a few novels and they're in different drafts. But I was just thinking that something unusual lately has been sort of, to me, the pandemic had sort of took a strange sort of psychic toll. There was something about being just confined and for a long stretch of time. I mean, it was good in some ways, but then it started to become very stale in a lot of ways. And there wasn't a lot of interaction with the world, which is not great because I like to travel and that stimulates the imagination and everything. And then you start getting into other, it's almost like a form of depression. It's been a little bit, at times I've encountered some issues, which I don't normally encounter, but.
But totally stripped us of culture, like for a while there. And I lost my live music outlet, which I just realized that's how I channel bliss, which is the kind of energy I need to infuse into creative production. Mm-hmm. So that was depressing as hell, just to get back to your point, like frustrating, depressing.
Right. And it's had, to me, it's had sort of a lingering effect too. It hasn't just dissipated completely, you know?
There's definitely a residual effect. Absolutely. I was even talking to that about my supervisor because I was feeling a lot of like latent kind of like depression and anger. Yeah. I get bursts of anger just with my frustration with the whole thing for reasons I won't get into, but
I understand it.
Yeah. And we were talking about how this is such a common thing, like in we're all expected to just bounce back and be like, everything's normal again.
Exactly.
We've all been collectively like traumatized for a long
time. I think absolutely that's true. And it's not just that. It's also, and I'm not getting into anything specific here because I can't deal with it in any way, but the polarization in the society too has been really weird. I mean, no matter what side of any fence you're on, I have a suspicion, unfortunately, that I'm a lot older than you guys. There was a whole huge, when I was growing up, a huge cultural clash during the Vietnam War years, you know, which I suspect just from looking at you guys weren't around.
Yeah, I was born in 72.
Yeah, okay. So you missed, it was really, really a tense time. It reminds me somewhat of that now. Sure. And but this one is even more poisonous in a way. this the whole the time we're living through right now. And so I think that's had an effect too. That's my observation. It's had an effect as well. Yeah, it's had an effect as well. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, just you know, random thoughts. I'm actually, I have to apologize. I'm very tired. I was in the Manhattan walking around all day and I'm exhausted. So my thoughts are not organized. So I have to apologize.
Oh, it's you're doing
I'm throwing fine. Out random stuff.
No, you're doing fine. You can leave whenever you're ready to.
I'm good. I just thought the one ironic thing that I wanted to throw out, it sort of makes me laugh a bit, is I'm working on this novel. And since we're talking about creative channeling today and mm-hmm. things that are sort of like beyond the scene, I always wanted to write a novel about the, I don't put this, like psychic experiences. So I've written this novel about a psychic.
I want to hear about that.
And a crime. I don't want to go to, I never talk about stuff that's in progress, but the ironic thing is, I mean, I always sort of can follow I have like general ideas about what I'm writing about in a, you know, plot wise with the novels. You have to sort of have that in mind.
But
this one, I've sort of encountered a block. Or I'm stuck on a plot point near the end of the novel that's not resolving. And it's kind of, I kind of find it ironic since the unconscious or something beyond is not throwing up a solution. It's kind of like I stopped working on the book after a few hundred pages. I mean, I expect I'll be able to finish it in some form.
Maybe you're approaching it with too much of your conscious.
It could be. Yeah, that could be. That's possible. Yeah, it's possible. Although I try to...
Maybe you should dance around like Keri Lee or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Your body.
What usually works for me is I'll think, when I encounter things like this, before I go to sleep at night, I'll start thinking about this plot. And then in the morning or somewhere along the line, a solution presents itself.
Yeah, your brain waves change right before sleep and stuff. So that
in this case, it's not happening. So, but anyway, I'm not going to stress about it too much because either it gets finished or it doesn't. You know,
it'll work out.
Yeah, you get to the point in life where you realize nothing's the end of the world. You know,
right?
So, what can you do? Some stuff works, some other things don't. You know.
I want to ask you as a writer, like, because I've also struggled a lot, especially when it comes to taking on like a novel or anything big like that. Like, how much of your story do you know you're going to write about in advance? Like, how much do you outline it out versus letting it kind of spontaneously emerge?
That's a good question. And I actually have an answer. And I talk a lot about this when I'm in book tours in Europe. When I was younger and was less sure of my abilities, I sort of outlined everything. And as I got older and more experienced as a writer, I will have broad outlines in my mind. And I start writing and let sort of things take over and emerge. So the outlines have, I don't want to say they've shrunk, but they sort of have shrunk. And I think the spontaneity and the accidental developments are always more interesting, in my opinion now. You know, like, so you sort of just like let yourself get led by what's happening in your story. You know what I mean?
That makes sense. It grows and evolves. So.
Yeah, it does. But to me, the one thing, there's one part of it for me, and everybody's different here. So and everyone's wired differently, but I go through between 10 and a dozen drafts of a novel.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I find, like, you write one draft, you go back, you revisit it, you add and subtract. You did that on the third draft. You do it on the fourth. You keep, a lot of times you keep adding, and then you start getting into those later drafts and you start throwing things out.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, this is by way of saying to me, what, there's only one thing that really works with writing, and that's like just sitting down and working at it over and over. And then eventually you just really get it out of your system and you're sick of working on it. I hit a point where I just get tired of working on the project. After 10 or 12 drafts, I can't even look at it anymore.
Oh, I know that feeling.
And I always have, like, I sort of have this vision of what I want to do, and I can never achieve it. Like, you come, it's like someone once said, and I also subscribe to this, pieces of art are never finished, they're abandoned. And I think there's a lot of truth in that. I get to a point where I just go, you know what, I can't do any better, that's, I'm done.
And then there's Picasso, who says inspiration does exist, but it has to find us working.
I think that's it. That's the core of it. And then eventually you just can't do any more with, you know, you do the best you can, you do a lot of work on it, and you know, that's it. The outlines are less and less defined as time has gone on. I mean, I have a broad outline because you obviously have to know something about what you're doing. And it's kind of good to have a point Z in mind. A lot of times I'll have a point A and B, and then C through Y is sort of unknown, and you get something out to Z. You know what I mean? So
it's the process.
But everything's different though. A lot of times, when a book comes relatively easy, I'll think it's really good, and then it fails to ignite the imagination of other people, let's say.
Yeah.
And sometimes I'll say, oh, this has been a beast and a bear, and I'm like struggling to get parts of it right and everything. And people will respond to that more. So it's not, you know, I think the mystery of the whole process never, you can never crack it. You can never crack it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I think that's right.
You think you can get your hands about it, around it, but you can't really.
Yeah.
And I find nothing really.
It's probably different for every writer.
Everybody's different too. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You said that.
Yeah.
I used to look at writing as like one book at a time, and now it's just like everything all the time, like in the sense that I was going to write the great book.
Right.
And now I'm just like, well, I'm going to write this book, I'll write that book, I'll write this, I'll tell some stories. And it's been like a personal thing to divorce myself from that first conception of the writer who writes the great book to the writer who's just going to get there however he can, you know.
Absolutely. I think
that's not the best way to describe it.
I think that, you know, getting there the best way you can is really, like, in the end, that's what you have to end up doing. You know what I mean?
Probably easier that way, you know, because you don't give yourself this trip about where you're going and you're going to get there and here you are and over there is your destination. You know, you're just going.
Well, I think that's what causes writer's block to begin with. Like, if you don't
a lot of personal, like, ego connection to the writer gambit that used to be overwhelmingly part of it.
What were you saying, Charlie? What were you saying?
I just think that's kind of like what writer's block comes from, is that feeling that you have to have this like perfect vision of everything.
I think so. Yeah.
Yourself in the book. And before you know it, you're infusing all that, you know, negative frustration and
self-doubt
into the process.
I've gotten to what's happening, for instance, for me, is that when I now having, you know, I've had a lot of books reviewed and criticized and everything. And so when I sit down now, that damn inner critic goes off and he starts saying, that sucks. That's not, you know, they're going to be on you for that. And that's not good. That's not good. But since I've, you know, enough of my work has collided with the world, and I know that it's either, you know, things are going to be criticized or thought to be bad or something, that critic voice goes starts right away. And I think that's why, I think as you get older and you do more, that inner critic becomes a real problem. And you have to try to go back and find some unfettered, like, you know, you want to really sort of get everything out there in those first drafts if you can.
Yeah, I agree.
I find that I can sometimes run into problems when I hear that inner critic start. That sucks. You suck. You know what I mean? Like that's the voice you hear. You thought this was good? You thought this was a good idea? You know, and that's something that you have to sort of like try to get away from, you know, and Kiri, was that her name? Kiri.
Yeah,
Kiri.
Kiri.
That's part of that in there too, is that social media is, you know, everybody. When I read reviews of my stuff online and what people say about me, it's like, oh, I want to strangle some people, you know, obviously. Yeah. But you can't, those voices coming in, because everybody has an opinion on something now. And you have to really suspend that. You know, you gotta get that stuff out of your head, which is not that easy to do in some ways. You know,
especially if you've got social media.
Exactly. That's what
Haven't like suicide rates like doubled since social media, like with like high schoolers and stuff?
Yeah.
Like, it's
yeah.
just like
yeah.
That's great.
Anyway,
I also wanted to ask you, Zach, have you done any more writing with Rachel? Because I remember you sent me like an excerpt from
that book. I finished that book, and it's in submission to four different places, and I should be hearing back in December. So, yeah, that's on its way.
Nice. It seems really interesting. I'd like to meet Rachel or talk more on a podcast with her
one of these days. I mean, I've never thought of doing them in the daytime, but I guess that's her comfort zone. Have you ever done a podcast in the daytime, either of you?
I probably be sharper.
Yeah, I guess we probably all would, right?
I mean, I would do it, you know.
It's kind of the same difference to me, I guess.
I mean, are you guys night?
I don't know. I'm just acculturated to do things at night, but there's no reason not to do it in the daytime.
Are you guys night birds or early guys?
I'm a night owl too, actually.
Not super night owl, but I stay up until about midnight.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, you guys aren't night owls at all. I guess I'm the only night
owl. Not really. Yeah. I mean, there's people up till 4:30 sometimes.
Oh yeah. I don't know how it's really. Yeah,
I can easily do that. I don't know. I like it because it's so peaceful, and I don't know. It's just that's like a magical time. It's actually
I'm not saying I'd never do it. I just don't tend to.
Well, yeah, I don't do it as much as I used to. I mean, it's hard to do that and maintain any kind of like daylight non-vampire schedule.
Yeah,
but sometimes it's really nice.
Of course, if you have jobs to deal with, you got to get up, right? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's not an issue, I guess. I mean, or it is an issue, but you got to just
not an option.
Yeah, well, I used to work at night, and I'd be like so wired after like work. I could never like go to sleep right after getting home from work. So I think that was part of what made me like start staying up really late.
So
it just depends what you're doing.
Have you guys heard of reverse speech?
Yeah, I remember you talking about that a long time ago at the church, actually. We had an interesting session around that.
I think we did it
with a few people, and we got some like really interesting results from
So there's this guy named David John Oates. David John Oates. And I don't know if you know the Art Bell Show, either of you. David John Oates promulgated his reverse speech theorem on the Art Bell Show. And the idea is that everyone speaks simultaneously forward and backward. And what you're saying in forward speech, you're actually saying the truth of in reverse speech. So he has all these reversals on politicians and stars and different celebrities, and they're all very titillating and provocative. But I was the guest writer at the Denver School of the Arts once, and my friend Daniel, Devin's brother, you know Devin, Devin's younger brother, Daniel showed up with his four-track, and we did reverse speech experiments with this literature class at Denver School of the Arts. Someone had just been raped, one of the girls had just been raped. We asked everyone to talk about it, and we played it in reverse. They were saying, stop, stop, you're hurting the angels, the nymphs. And it was like, whoa. You could have heard a pin drop. It was incredible. And I thought, man, I'm really onto something incredible here, but nothing really came of it. It was just that one unforgettable visiting artist time at Denver School of the Arts. But isn't that an interesting idea? And I don't know if it's plausible, but what's implausible anymore? I mean, maybe it is plausible that you're speaking in reverse at the same time and that you're like telling your true feelings in the reverse, even when you're lying in the forward. I don't know. It's an interesting idea.
It is. Yeah. And I like, and you know, I like your idea that nothing is implausible anymore. I think that's something that's,
I mean, doesn't it seem?
Oh yeah. 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 I was telling someone today that what I'm striving for now in my writing, and I think I've done it to some extent, but is to write like all human behavior is irrational. And I like the action in my books to be completely irrational, and I don't want to explain it.
I like it. So no positive negative feelings.
Yeah, and I find it irrational. I find that interesting. Like,
that was the motivation behind the surrealism movement and a lot of stuff, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. I love like movies that are deliberately nonsensical. And
I know what you mean.
Achieve their own paralogic in the process.
It can be sometimes hard to pull that off in a way too. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like where you just let go and everyone is the irrationality of life just presents itself. But yeah, that's, you know, but yeah, I like that idea. What's implausible nowadays? Nothing really, you know?
Right.
Nothing. Yeah. Nothing makes any sense. Not that it ever did. I don't think it ever did.
I'm not feeling terrified though. I know a lot of people are like, "Oh, it's the end of the world. It's death."
No, I don't. You know. I think it's always been insane. I think it's always been.
It's always been this way. This
is just more obvious how insane it is now.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. Absolutely. Yep. I remember. You know, I lived right across and my wife worked in Tower One, the World Trade Center on the 55th floor, you know? Yeah. And we looked out from our apartment right at the, you know, and to this day, just the idea of like, hey, so 19 guys are going to fly planes into the World Trade Center and destroy them. It's like, like if someone told you that a year before it happened, you would say, "This, you're crazy. This, that sounds completely nuts," and they pulled it off, you know. So
did you see those come down live?
I was actually it was weird. I had to go and work out to the west. My wife was in the city that day because we lived right across the river. Right, literally, we could throw stone to the.
And I'm assuming she survived and everything.
Yeah, yeah. She actually left the job shortly before that happened. But we knew a lot of people that died, you know. And but it was, I mean, people stood there and literally watched them collapse. It was just the most talk about surreal sights, you know. It was a really surreal sight. So and if someone ever told you, well, this is going to happen, you would be, you know, it doesn't make any sense at all. So
And we were in such a bubble before that event. Like when I think about it now, we're like completely different as a collective people.
Oh yeah.
Before 9/11. I remember talking to somebody about like, why do all the other countries have wars happening in them? And we just never had a war. And he was just kidding, but he was like, oh, we're the free souls, you know, just, and it was easy to believe that kind of thing. Like somehow we just don't have wars here.
Yeah.
Don't have bombs, don't have destruction. And then the World Trade Center comes down. That was a huge change.
You know, I always thought, no one ever talks about this, but I always thought what was really nutty, I mean, talk about like implausibility was, if I said to you, you know, I'm going to get 19 guys together and we're going to get them like to go into these flight schools in the US and they're going to go and hijack these planes and fly them. I mean, the plan sounds so absurdly ridiculous that you could get.
Sounds really workable to me.
It does. Yeah. See, to me, it sounds
maybe
like.
Maybe because I'm of a younger breed.
It could. Yeah. I mean, you can't get 19 people to decide where to go to dinner. Let alone get everybody to like decide to commit suicide at the same time and fly into these, but you know what I mean? It's just, it sounded really nutty to me. It sounded like really like it's like a plot that a hack writer would dream up and, you know, and,
well, I kind of see what you mean. Yeah, it seems,
you know,
like,
what I mean, it's like
it could have come out in the 70s. Oh, they tried to do this but they were foiled, you know, they're amateur.
It just doesn't, and they pulled it off.
They pulled it off.
It's like the Ian Fleming James Bond books and movies. We're like living a James Bond movie now, like the kinds of
right
conniving and like plotting and
exactly.
I try not to involve my attention in that stuff though. I mean, I know it goes on, there's this whole class of people that devotes themselves to that and they do their stuff.
That's the 1%.
I'm just the art guy, you know. I'll write a story, I'll draw a picture, I'll
well, that's smart. Nice, that's how you keep your vibration high so you can
It's working so far,
but
sometimes you end up in these conversations where they people expect you to be more committed to the, you know, crisis. And it's hard. I've never seem to pull it off.
You're too transcendent,
or too gullible, or something.
Anyway.
Oh shit.
Guys, I'm going to.
I was going to say we got to wrap up.
This seems like a good time to say goodnight.
Okay.
Thanks for
good
coming
talking to you all.
Dunlap. Thanks for coming, Mark Sofranco, and I'll talk to you both again.
Okay.
Have a great rest of the evening.
You too.
Yeah.
Good night, guys. Good meeting you. Good talking to you.
Yeah. You too, Mark.
Okay. Good luck with everything. Have a nice holiday too.
Good night, everybody.
Okay.
Peace.
Yeah, and happy holidays.